This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Stephen W. Dant. Today is March 4th, 2005. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. It's approximately 8:36 a.m. Central Standard Time, and Mr. Dant is in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Steve, why don't we start with some biographical information on yourself? Can you tell me where you were born, when you were born, and a little bit about your childhood?
I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, August 30th, 1949. Both my parents are Hoosiers.
Mm-hmm.
Come from Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was from Indianapolis. My dad grew up on a farm in southern Indiana.
Okay.
I lived in Indianapolis when I was very young, and then we moved out to about, I don't know, 20 miles outside of Indianapolis, mm-hmm. into a rural area. There was a pocket of about five or six homes. My dad commuted every day into Indianapolis,
mm-hmm.
where he worked for the railroad as a low-end or lower supervisory role of scheduling cars for the, at that time, it was the New York Central Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
My parents are devout Catholics. I'm the what ended up with being the oldest of 11 children.
Wow.
When we left Indiana, when I was about 10 or 11 years old,
mm-hmm.
I think I was in the fourth grade, my dad got transferred to Cleveland.
Okay.
And I think when we left in Indiana, I think there were six of us, and I think when we left Cleveland after 2 years, he got transferred to New York.
New York City.
New York City.
Okay.
How
old were you when that happened?
When I moved to New York, I was seventh grade, so what's that, 12, 13?
Around 13.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. There were, I think, eight of us when we left Cleveland, and then there were three more born in New York. So I went to junior high and high school and community just outside of Peekskill, New York,
mm-hmm.
where I lost my Midwestern accent and gained a New York accent,
okay.
Which I've subsequently lost along the way as I got into broadcasting, but that's another story.
How do you spell Peekskill?
It's Peekskill.
Okay. And whereabouts is that?
It's about 45, 50 miles north of New York City, right on the Hudson River.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of the last, for a lot of trains, the commuter stop into New York.
Okay.
So my dad took the train into New York City every day.
What was his job in New York?
Similar to what it was in Indianapolis and in Cleveland. He worked in an office that scheduled virtually all of the cars. And for a while, where he worked with passenger, and then he worked with freight.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine doing this without computers.
Yes.
All over the entire line. And so he was one of the supervisors of overseeing that.
Okay. Did you have any people in your family, your dad or uncles or grandparents, anybody involved in the military?
I had some most of my uncles who were military age during World War II,
mm-hmm.
were deferred because they were working on farms.
Okay.
My dad couldn't go into the Army because he had health problems. He had MS as a child or some form of it. So all of his life he's had problems getting around.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me
I have had some cousins who were in the Army or Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to see them every once in a while.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about your mom. What was she like? Did she work, or she? I imagine she had her hands full at home.
Yeah, she did. She's grew up in Indianapolis. She graduated from nursing school, married my dad, so she's a registered nurse, an RN.
Okay.
You know, which is helpful bringing up 11 kids.
Mm-hmm.
She was a good mom. We all seemed to do okay. And she did work from time to time out of the home. She would occasionally work weekends or work a night shift here and there to kind of supplement the family income, you know, which I would describe as probably lower middle class.
Okay. Well, you've moved around quite a bit here. You've gone, I'm counting, four different places by the time you were 13, or excuse me, 14 or 15. Did you finish high school in Peekskill?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was it like moving around like that? Was it difficult for you?
Yes, it was and it wasn't. I mean, in some ways, looking back on it, I think it better prepares you for life and adjusting to new situations.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're growing up, it's tough because you're having to make new friends and get accepted in new places.
Sure.
And in those days, I'm not sure that this is true anymore, but the Ohio school systems were ahead of the Indiana school systems, and the New York school systems, at least in the schools that I went to, were ahead of the Ohio school systems, particularly in the math and science area.
So
I can remember moving to Cleveland and leaving Indiana and just getting through my multiplication tables and getting to Cleveland, and they were standing up there doing long division or something to that effect.
Right.
You know? Right. And then it was another step ahead when I moved from Ohio to New York.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, another half a grade ahead of what I was in Ohio. So
right.
That was probably the most difficult part of my move.
Yeah.
Is trying to play catch up.
Yeah. What kind of student were you, Steve?
Oh, I'd say I was B's and C's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, C's towards the end of my high school years, as I was less and less motivated.
What were your favorite subjects?
Favorite subject was history, English, social studies. Least favorite was math and science.
Okay. What were your duties at home? You were the oldest, so what was expected of you?
Yeah, when you're the oldest, you kind of become a third parent once you reach a certain age. And me and my sister, I have seven brothers, by the way, three sisters.
Okay.
So me and Mary Jane, the oldest girl, end up kind of taking on more responsibilities once you hit about, I'd say about 11 or 12, 13, you find yourself, you know, the family goes to church in segments, you know. There's six that go into the early Mass and another six go to the 10 o'clock Mass. So if the parents are going together, then Mary Jane and I would be watching a group that was home. And you learn to do things like make breakfast, and you know, I could fry an egg when I was, you know, 11, 12 years old.
Right.
Knew how to make meatloaf and pork chops and
the whole thing.
All kinds of things.
Yeah. Did you like that? Did you enjoy that role? I mean, I guess you didn't really have a choice.
Yeah. I never really thought about it.
Uh-huh.
It was there, and so you know, you deal with. Like everybody else, you deal with what the cards that you're given.
Sure.
Or you play the cards you're given. I'm mixing my metaphors.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that helped you as a leader in later in life?
I think so. Sure. You know, one of the things I've interviewed for jobs along the way in the broadcast industry that I'm in, and I tell people that, you know, I've been in management all my life.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you, first of all, in New York City, what was that like back? Now, this is in the 1950s, I presume, or early 60s?
Early 60s.
Oh, early 60s.
Yeah.
Can you describe New York City to us?
I used to go to New York every once in a while when I was, you know, I used to take dates in high school. We'd get on the train. I could ride free on the train because my dad worked for the railroad. So
right.
Everybody in the family had a train pass.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, sidebar story, I mean, that's how we used to go back and visit folks in Indiana after we'd moved to New York, because we had a large family, had a lot of aunts and uncles that also had a lot of children, mm-hmm. and half of us would ride on the train, get on the train in Peekskill and get off in Indianapolis, and the other half would ride the station wagon across from New York to Indiana.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, yeah, I used to go into the city every once in a while, either catch a show or more often than not with a couple of my friends, and we'd take the train into Grand Central and then get on a subway and go out to Yankee Stadium and watch the Yankees play a doubleheader.
I was going to ask you if you're a Yankees fan or a Mets fan.
I'm not anymore, but okay. When I lived there, I was a Yankee fan.
Okay.
And had the opportunity to see Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle and all those guys.
Wow. I bet that was a lot of fun.
Yep.
How many times were you going to games? I mean, did you go to two or three, or were you go to 10?
I go a couple of games in the summer.
Okay.
At least two or three.
Yeah. Now, that brings up sports. Were you into sports as a youngster?
Oh, yeah. I loved playing baseball. Mm-hmm. I played a lot of sandlot basketball. I played on a high school football team.
What position did you play?
I played defensive corner.
Okay.
And first string defense, second string offense.
Right.
And I played a lot of special teams. Mm-hmm. Ran back kickoffs and was on the punting team and kickoff team. And
mm-hmm. Well. Tell me, early 1960s, this is the Kennedy years, and what was the mood like in the house around John Kennedy, a Catholic president? And
well, I was in Catholic high school at the time. I went to 1 year of Catholic high school.
Okay.
At Archbishop Stepanak High School, actually their annex, which was in Tarrytown, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being in what were we in? We were in some kind of assembly at the time, and one of the brothers walked in and said, the president's been shot, and it's reported that he's been killed. And, just the whole place was just stunned. Mm. Nobody could move. Mm-hmm. It seemed like for 5 or 10 minutes.
Mm. Were your parents supporters of Kennedy?
Yes. Yeah. They were... As I remember, political talk in the House, it was pretty much politics were pretty much Democrat Party as opposed to Republican.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's changed along the way over the last 30 years or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of my folks became more Republican after Reagan became president. It was pretty much Democratic politics in the House, when Kennedy, I don't know how else to describe it, when Kennedy got shot and killed, it just kind of did stun the family.
Mm-hmm.
And it stunned everybody.
Sure. Absolutely. Did you like Kennedy? Do you remember how you thought about him as a president?
I remember liking him. There was an aura around that White House at the time.
And, mm-hmm.
I remember the aura being as much around Jacqueline Kennedy mm-hmm. as much as being around John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she brought something to the White House that, I describe it as a sophistication. The women that I was around, including my mom,
mm-hmm.
Admired her very much for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it was the fact that there were young kids in the White House, and that hadn't been the case in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were all families with young kids, so there was, you could relate somewhat on that level as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, tell me about your high school years. What do you remember most about high school when you think back to it?
I enjoyed high school. I didn't enjoy the academic part of it towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. Because it was, I was still in some ways trying to play catch up from my earlier years.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a good set of friends in high school. I found that I was, adept at how there are different cliques in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I could hang out with the jocks,
mm-hmm.
and I could also hang out with the more blue collar folks,
mm-hmm.
because I could kind of relate to them coming from, I felt like I had some blue collar background.
Right.
And I was also on the class council. I don't know how I got elected to that. And if you're on a high school football team, that helps as well.
Sure. Right. What about girlfriends? Were you dating in high school?
Yeah, I was dating in high school. I had a pretty steady girlfriend throughout most of my high school years.
Right. Okay.
We kind of separated after we both kind of went to college.
Mm-hmm. What years were you there in high school, Steve?
Well, I went to two different high schools. I should back up on that. I went to Catholic high school, which I really hated.
Why?
Because I found that you were either there because you were going to be a priest or a brother,
mm-hmm.
or you had some kind of problems. People were trying to straighten you out by putting you in a stricter school, and so I didn't fit in that mold very well.
Right.
And in fact, ended up getting in a couple fights in high school with guys who were, thought that they were Buster badasses, and I really was the kind of person that, even if I thought I wasn't going to win this fight, I wasn't backing up an inch.
Right.
So I won a couple and lost a couple, but it really seemed like it was a very tense ninth grade.
Right.
And so I convinced my parents, although I think it broke my mother's heart at the time, after I'd been in a parochial school for 9 years,
mm-hmm.
To go to the public high school.
Right.
She was mad at me for a while, but eventually she got over it.
So you spent your ninth grade year at the Catholic high school.
Right. And then I went to Lakeland High School, which is actually in Shrub Oak, New York, which is, kind of a community just outside of Peekskill.
Okay. And what year did you graduate?
1967.
Okay. Wow, right there in the middle of the war.
Right in the middle of it.
Yeah. Tell me, before we go past high school, what was your impression of first Lyndon Johnson taking over and what he was doing as president, and did you have much of an opinion or not? And then let me know what you thought about the Vietnam War and what was happening in Southeast Asia.
I didn't know what to think about Lyndon Johnson, other, to know that he certainly wasn't the, not a word I think I would have used at the time, but
mm-hmm.
The charismatic leader that John Kennedy was.
Mm-hmm.
I did, as I was in high school, that as you start moving out of your freshman year to sophomore year to junior year,
mm-hmm.
you suddenly become more aware of the Vietnam War, because you start to know people who are soldiers who are going over there or coming back home.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, there was an apprehension that some of us were going to have to go over there, although we all understood that we all had friends. As you get into your junior year, then friends who go off to college, who are, dealing with the deferments that a college will get you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
No, you are. Exactly. Totally. I mean, this is a unique time for you because, you I would imagine that you do know people who are graduating
right.
a couple years in front of you who are faced with going to a war, going to college, and making a choice or not having a choice sometimes.
There also, I remember there were a couple of young teachers,
mm-hmm.
particularly a history teacher I had, and I don't remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was my sophomore or junior year. And obviously, if he's just graduated from college and he's 22 or, you know, 23 years old,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he's in good health. He's I don't think he was married at the time. It meant he was top of the list to be drafted.
Sure, yeah.
And so I had a few teachers like that, and he got in trouble, as I recall. This happened back in the 60s as well as it happens today, for espousing some of his beliefs about the war in the classroom. And I remember he would on one afternoon, I think it was a Friday afternoon or something, he was in the classroom, he was playing Bob Dylan songs to the class.
Okay. What were you all thinking when you're hearing Dylan sing?
I thought it was cool at the time.
Yeah.
But as I remember, he got in some trouble for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he got that summer he got drafted.
Do you know whatever happened to him?
No, I don't.
Wow. Well, what did you think of the Vietnam War personally? I mean, did you know why the United States was even there, or was it kind of a mystery to you all?
You know, I remember hearing a lot about the domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we didn't stop the communists in Southeast Asia, and the next place was going to be Thailand, and
mm-hmm.
then it was going to be the Philippines, so, you know, and I think I kind of bought into that when I was.
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard it,
mm-hmm.
You know, because we come through World War II, and you know, I was the generation that was the son of a lot of World War II veterans were parents of kids my age.
Yes.
And I had one cousin who was in the Korean War. You know, and so I kind of equated it, I guess, kind of thought of it as another Korea.
Did your cousin talk to you about Korea?
No. I just it was that time I was kind of really young, and
mm-hmm.
I was just kind of amazed to see this guy in a uniform, you know.
Right. Did you think at all when you were a kid, not in high school, but when you were really younger, about wearing that uniform, about going into the military?
You know, I guess I enjoyed cowboy and Indian pictures, and I liked wartime pictures, but
mm-hmm.
I never really thought of myself as being a professional soldier, if that's what you're asking.
Well, did you see yourself like, wow, I'd like to be a soldier one day, you know, or I'd like to be a Marine one day? Tell me, Steve, when you graduated in '67, I mean, the war is in full swing here, and tell me about going to college. Were you encouraged to go to college? Did you want to go? Was it, did it have something to do with the war about your entry into college?
I did want to go to college. I did see myself as getting a degree in something. I wasn't sure what. I did have an interest even at that time in broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents say, you know, Steve, we really want you to go on and continue your education, or was it really up to you?
They encouraged me to go to school to get a college degree. My parents didn't have a bachelor's degrees, but my dad had an associate degree, and my mother an RN as a 2-year program. I think so. They understood the value of a higher education.
Mm-hmm.
I was encouraged to go to school, and all of my friends. We're going to college.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just most of the group that I was hanging out with. It was just a given that you were going somewhere, and so I kind of rode that whole wave.
Mm-hmm.
Where
were you interested in going?
Well, I was interested in going to the SUNY system,
mm-hmm.
which is really the one that I could afford.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was going to have to pay for this myself, which meant student loans, because my parents couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But my grades had deteriorated enough in And by the time I was in my senior year, that I, most of the places I got accepted to were two-year schools, junior colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I ended up going.
Okay. Which one?
Went to SUNY at Morrisville, New York, up near Syracuse.
Okay. And you were there for 2 years?
I was there for a year.
Okay.
I was totally bored. Uninspired.
Mm-hmm.
I was partying a lot.
Uh-huh.
I was a disc jockey at the school radio station. I was on the basketball team. I was on the ski team, and I wasn't doing a whole lot of studying. Even with the Vietnam War hanging over my head, I just couldn't get inspired to
mm-hmm.
go to school.
So what happened after that year?
I think I had a bad case what do they give kids Ritalin for? Attention deficit disorder.
Okay.
Yeah, Ritalin probably would have helped me.
Right, right.
You know, I was a pretty hyper person. And I was partying too. I was
uh-huh.
you know, I was smoking too much marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people were doing at the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is right in the middle
this
of the
60s.
The
right.
60s, right. This
right.
is lots of stuff happening socially
yeah.
in the country. Do you remember what you thought about the civil rights movement? That, I mean, it was really 57 to 64, 65, but
I was four square behind what was happening in the civil rights movement. You know,
mm-hmm.
I saw the things on TV that were going on in Alabama and Mississippi and marches in Washington, and
mm-hmm.
And there was no question in my mind that you know, if I'd have been on the streets, I'd have been marching with the folks,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the black civil rights, as opposed to the cops who were trying to beat them over the head with nightsticks.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, and I think most of my friends' peer group at the time felt the same way.
Okay.
So there were a lot of women's rights groups.
Yes.
Women's issues at the same time, too.
Yes.
I mean, that's the time that the bras start coming off.
Mm-hmm.
Which was nice in a way.
I wasn't going to say anything. I was going to let you take that one. Well, yeah, this is a time of social revolution
yeah.
in the United States, and
yeah.
you're smack dab in the middle of it, and you're in your first year of college, and you're having a good time.
Yeah.
So after this year up at Morrisville, what did you where
so
were you
I
plans?
Dropped out of Morrisville. I moved back home, and I went to was going for about a year or so to a community college
uh-huh.
There, but it ended up being more part time than full time.
Uh-huh. And that ensured your deferment, I take it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But about that time, my dad got transferred again.
Mm-hmm.
And he got transferred to Philadelphia.
Okay.
So they moved to Newark, Delaware, which is just south of Wilmington.
Mm-hmm.
But Wilmington's a short train ride into Philly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was got an apartment over near the community college, and was there for about 6 months. But that neighborhood ended up turning into a rough neighborhood, and a lot of drug dealers were living there, and police were showing up a lot at night, and I thought, I got to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So I quit school and went and followed my folks down to Delaware and got a full-time job working for some division of DuPont.
Okay.
You know, making, I don't know what I was doing, I was testing some kind of equipment that went into fighter aircraft.
Okay. So in the defense industry, in a way.
Yeah, right.
Okay. This is what, 1969?
This is
70?
This is 1968.
Okay.
Probably late 1968.
Okay.
And early 69.
Okay. And what was your draft status?
Well, at the time when I dropped out of school, I became 1A, and received a draft notice in I think it was March of '69.
Okay. What did you think when you got that?
Here we go.
I mean, were you expecting it?
Yeah, I know it was just a matter of time, and I had some friends who had gotten drafted. I had a lot of friends who were trying to talk me into going to Canada.
Really?
Yeah.
Why didn't you go?
I just couldn't picture myself avoiding the draft. It would have really been a slap in the face to my parents.
Did you feel a duty to your country, or is
I did. I mean, I guess I was brought up that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were a pretty red, white, and blue family.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting arguments with my dad about demonstrators in, I don't remember where they were. Maybe it was during the 68 convention in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
where the police went after the demonstrators in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all upset that the students were getting beat up, and my dad said, well, they shouldn't be there in the first place. And we had quite a little 20-minute argument.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I was convinced that the war was wrong in 68 or 69.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't convinced that the people who were I didn't have a lot of high regard for Johnson, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never enamored with Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't think very highly of those guys, but I can't, you know, it's kind of hard to remember all this stuff. But
sure.
I wasn't the kind that was going to go demonstrate against the war.
Right. Do you remember who you voted for in 68?
Well, I wasn't eligible. Because
you weren't 18?
Yeah. Well, no.
Oh, that's right. That's right. The age hadn't changed.
Hadn't changed.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, so you're going to go to the war now. Your draft, you're going to... Your report for basic, and did you want to go in a particular branch? Did you want to try to go enlist and do something like that?
Well, I remember thinking at the time, I'm just going to go get this over with.
Okay.
I'm gonna do my duty and take the shortest route mm-hmm. through this thing and get back out and
mm-hmm.
then figure out what I'm going to do with my life.
Were your parents supportive of you going over? I mean, obviously they're going to be worried out, as parents would be, but how do they feel when they knew you were going to be drafted and eventually you would be in the war zone?
Well, I think that they were apprehensive. They were scared. But I believe that they felt like, you know, it was if one of their children was going to get drafted, then it was their duty to go.
Right. Okay.
And it was a strange summer to get drafted. I was constantly back and forth visiting to friends I had still up in Peekskill.
Mm-hmm.
And we rode over and was at Woodstock for an afternoon
mm-hmm.
To see all of that.
During the festival?
During the festival.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like?
Muddy. Wet.
Right.
You know, you could see the stage way down there.
Uh-huh.
And we had to hike like 10 miles to get there because it was just the roads were jammed and packed. And, you know, once we got there, we only stayed there a few hours and turned around and left because it was just, it was a mess, I thought.
Did you hear any music?
I heard some, but I don't remember who was down there. I think it was Richie Havens.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So you were actually at the Woodstock Festival.
Yeah.
Okay. So
a few minutes later, I was getting my hair cut.
Right. So where are you going to report to? Where were you ordered to go?
I got my draft notice to be inducted in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Actually, I was drafted. My draft board was in Peekskill,
mm-hmm.
but the orders came for me to show up in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. And when did you go?
I think it was September of early September of 69.
Okay. And this is the U.S. Army.
U.S. Army.
Right. And where did you go for basic?
I went to, first they sent us down after we were inducted. And the induction process, I remember they pulled like six of us outside before the induction, and they said, we're drafting into the Marines this morning.
Oh, right.
one of you six guys is going to be a Marine, and he volunteers.
Really?
Yeah.
How did they pick the six of you?
They took the fourth guy alphabetically.
Okay.
And he went out crying.
Oh, wow.
Because from what we heard, they don't treat drafted Marines as well as they treat guys who volunteer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Now, did you have any desire to be a Marine?
No.
Okay. Well, right, because you wanted to kind of get the...
I wanted to get this, responsibility done and over with.
Right. Okay. So... when you're inducted, where do they send you? Right.
First went to Fort Bragg.
Okay.
Where I took a whole battery of tests, and originally I think I was supposed to go to basic there, but they ran out of room for us, and so they sent a couple bus loads of us down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Now, I guess that was a bit of culture shock for you.
Yes.
Tell me about what North Carolina and South Carolina were like for a boy from...
I knew some of that because I still had a lot of relatives in southern Indiana.
Right.
So southern... I don't know if you have traveled through southern Indiana, which is, in my mind, more like Kentucky than Indiana.
Yes, it's very rural. And
very rural and a lot of southern accents. And so it reminded me of where my dad grew up, of, Lagodi, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And... so I don't think I was as shocked as some of the other guys that were with me on the trip.
Mm-hmm. Well, so tell me about basic training. What was it like? What do you remember?
A lot of up at 4:35 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
After coming from the environment I was coming from, where you'd go to work at 9 or 8:30 or something.
Right.
Getting up and doing PT at dawn was different.
Mm-hmm.
The drill sergeants seemed like they were in your face all the time.
Mm-hmm.
No, they were trying to, like the book says, they're trying to get you to think like a soldier as opposed to a civilian.
Mm-hmm. Were these guys Vietnam vets, Steve?
Yeah, some of them were. And I think that at least a couple of them that I met, I thought that looking back on it, I think in their hearts they were really trying to get you ready in case you were sent to Vietnam, mm-hmm. so that you'd be as prepared as you could be when you got there.
Right.
Particularly some of the instructors who were out, you marched different places during the day to learn different how to operate different weapons or whatever.
Right.
And that was particularly the case, not so much in basic, but when you got to AIT,
mm-hmm.
Which for me was advanced infantry training,
mm-hmm.
Those guys really, you could tell that they wanted you paying attention, and if you weren't, they were in your face, but I think they were in their face because they realized most of you guys are not going to Germany.
Right.
You're going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So did you adapt well to military life at basic?
I guess I adapted as well as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any real run-ins with any of the sergeants. I didn't have any problem marching and mm-hmm. and cadence and... I did well on the rifle range, and somewhere along the line, the process started that, and this would happen to me every once in a while. They'd take a group of three or four of us and take us into the mess hall, and try to convince us to enlist for another year and make us into warrant officers or want to send us to officer candidate school. Because I guess I had done well on the aptitude test that you take when you when you first put on your uniform.
When you were at Bragg.
When I was at Bragg, right.
What were your thoughts on that? Were you still committed to kind of getting your enlistment?
Yeah, I thought about it a couple of times about being a helicopter pilot. I thought that might be cool. But, you know, that was a commitment of, I've forgotten what it was, but it just seemed at the time like a long time. I was going to have to be in the Army for 6 years, and I thought, man, I don't want to. I just don't see myself doing this for 6 years. So I just kept on, you know, staying the course of I'm going to do my duty and get this done and be a good soldier and go home.
What would you say was the most difficult thing about basic training for you?
Lack of sleep. I just always seemed like you were, you know, you that you never got enough sleep. And you know, and I guess that's you know, prepares you for when you get into a combat situation, because you know, once I got to Vietnam, if you're out in the field, I mean, that's, you're dealing with sleep deprivation all the time.
Right. What was the easiest thing to you in basic?
Probably weapons training. You know, I just, although I was never a hunter as a kid, I grew up in the country. And, I guess also the patrol stuff, learning to read maps. I Peekskill was kind of a rural area at the time I grew up. I was always in the woods. You know, I was a Boy Scout and Explorer Scout. I was with a scout troop with explorers that we always, you know, we did a lot of canoeing, canoe rides down the Susquehanna, the Delaware River, a lot of outdoor camping. So I didn't have a problem with sleeping outside, pitching tents, dealing with reading trail maps that a lot of other guys really had a tougher time getting used to.
Right. Were you a leader, Steve, or were you kind of trying to blend in, stay under the radar?
I was, you know, at that time just trying to stay under the radar.
Okay.
I wasn't made, I've forgotten what they made the leaders in the companies you were in the barracks. I wasn't a barracks leader or any of that stuff.
Okay.
I was just, you know, low profile.
How'd you get along with everybody else there?
I got along with, you know, everyone else pretty good. I mean, I don't remember getting into any fights with anybody or anything. You know, everybody in a barracks sometime or another going to get crossed with somebody, but I got along pretty much with everybody.
Okay. Your family was still okay with everything going on?
Yep.
Okay. So, at the end of basic, you're going to go to AIT. Were you selected infantry? Did you request it?
No, I was selected.
Okay. How did that happen? Were you kind of trying to get away from that? I mean, that is something that's going to really dictate your future in Vietnam, that you're going to be a rifleman versus doing something else.
Yeah, as I remember, I think we were kind of, it was after we graduated from basic, you know, you do this graduation ceremony. God, I forgot about that. Or maybe it was just before, but somewhere along the line, you know, you're in formation and they start peeling you off to, handing you a piece of paper and peeling you off to certain trucks that are going to take you to a different part of the base, or you're packing up to leave to go to some other fort someplace for whatever specialized training. And so that's when I got handed the sheet that said that I was going to advanced infantry training.
How'd you feel?
So I guess that I had somewhere in the back of my head had kind of resolved that that there was more probability that was going to happen than not.
Okay.
So I guess I wasn't really surprised.
Okay. Where did you go for AIT?
I stayed at Fort Jackson.
Okay, so you stayed right there.
I just moved down the road.
Okay. How long was your advanced? Was it 9 weeks?
Yeah, 9, 10 weeks, something like that.
Okay. Tell me about what they taught you. How did it differ from basic?
Well, the drill sergeants weren't in your face the way they were in basic.
Mm-hmm.
You were a soldier now. I mean, you weren't some trainee. And I think that there was, it was still tough and it was still very disciplined,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't in your face discipline like it is in basic.
Right.
I think, as I said earlier, that's when, you go through some of the same training that you're in basic.
Mm-hmm.
Only it's a little more in depth and a little more intense. I mean, you learn how to strip down a rifle when you're in basic, but when you're in AIT, they expect you to practically do it blindfold,
mm-hmm.
and to really know the weapons system or the weapons that you're going to be utilizing inside out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you spend a lot more time on the firing range. You really spend a lot of time with claymores and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable with all of the weapons?
Yeah, I never had a problem with any of the weapons that I was trained on. There were, I did feel like there were some that I knew I was going to be more comfortable with,
mm-hmm.
than others.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
Well, I really couldn't see myself, if I'm out defending myself, I couldn't see myself carrying an M79.
Mm-hmm.
I'd much rather have an M16 in my hand.
Mm-hmm. What kind of field tactics were you learning? What were they drilling you on there?
Learned about a lot about camouflage,
mm-hmm.
a lot about what was called, what do they call it? Concealment, techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for the right kind of cover,
mm-hmm.
versus concealment.
Mm-hmm.
Learning how to read trails, read maps.
Mm-hmm.
How to spot booby traps.
I guess that's where a lot of their, I would imagine, where they brought in what the instructors experienced in,
right.
Vietnam. Did they specifically say, here's what the Viet Cong, here's what to look for?
Well, they had examples of different booby traps that the VC were utilizing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from punji stakes to tripwires and,
mm-hmm.
Holes dug in the ground that you'd fall into, those kinds of things. And so there was. And what to look for in terms of when you're walking a trail,
mm-hmm.
what to step on, what not to step on.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot more training at night.
They teach you how to ambush, things like,
yeah,
that?
Yeah, those kinds of things.
How about, did they teach you how to walk point?
I don't remember that being part of the curriculum.
Tell me what you're feeling as you're, you're going through this and okay, all of this is leading to me shipping off to a war where I'm going to be really doing this for real. What's that like? Is this something you even think about, or is it way kind of in the back of your minds?
What's the word I'm searching for? Surrealistic.
Okay.
You're almost kind of outside yourself watching yourself go through this.
Right.
Really not believing that it's happening sometimes.
Right. Is it scary?
Well, yeah. I mean, it seems like you're very apprehensive. And I'm looking back, I guess you're more apprehensive about the unknown than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no way, even though all these guys are describing how you, what you need to do in different kinds of situations, there's no way that they can describe it to the point where you really understand what's going to happen here.
Right. Was there any excitement?
I don't remember anybody being excited about the possibility of going into combat or going to Vietnam.
So all this stuff these Marines have been telling me is a bunch
of
bunk. Like they can't wait to go over and kill a commie for mommy.
Yeah, I don't. I never bought into that.
Okay. Anything else about Advance that you want to talk about? Any incidents that happened before you graduate and get ready to go?
No, I think it was pretty, what I went through was probably pretty normal.
Mm-hmm. This is 1969?
This is,
Or are you into 70 now?
This is, late 69, and I may have been, I can't remember, did I go home for Christmas or not? I think I was, and then I went back to the base and finished up a couple weeks, and then I had a week's leave or something like that, and
mm-hmm.
I shipped over in early February of 70.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and stop here, Steve? This would be a good place where we can pause and continue another time.
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Stephen Dant. Today is March 9th, 2005. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room. And Mr. Dant is in Colorado Springs, and it is about 8:23 a.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Dant, why don't we continue with where we were. Tell me a little bit about before you went over to Vietnam and what you were feeling. You had some time off before you were deployed. What did you do? Did you go back home?
I went back home, visited some friends, went to a few parties.
Mm-hmm.
Spent whatever money I had in my pocket.
Mm-hmm. What were your friends saying to you? What do you recall?
I think that, as I remember, they were just, I don't remember exactly what was said, but, wishing me a lot of luck, and I think they were apprehensive and a little afraid for me.
Did they know you were going to be a rifleman, basically?
Yeah, they knew I was infantry.
Okay.
Yep.
How were you feeling?
About the same. I resigned to the situation, but I didn't want to go, but I kind of wanted to go and get it over with.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents have anything to say, especially about it? I mean, I can only imagine they were upset and a little worried.
Yeah, my parents are quiet people to begin with, but they were seemed to me more quiet during this period.
Mm-hmm.
They took me to the airport, saw me off on a plane. I mean, we just kind of sat there and looked at each other for about 15, 20 minutes, it seemed like. And then lots of hugs and kisses, and I was off.
Wow. And you flew from where?
I flew from Philadelphia mm-hmm. to Seattle, Washington,
mm-hmm.
and then was in... Fort Lewis, Washington, for a few days, I think 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I remember seeing one of the greatest renditions of Jailhouse Rock that I could ever remember. Some guy was on the barracks were two-floor barracks, and I don't know, some guy from, I met him later, he's from Tennessee or Kentucky or somewhere in there, just got up on, we were all sitting there in a chow line or something, and he stepped out into this, onto this balcony of, or this walkway that got you down to the ground, maybe it was a fire escape, and just had a broom there, and started singing into the broom handle, Elvis's Jailhouse Rock. We gave him a standing ovation. Kind of lightened up the time that we were all there.
Yeah. What was the mood like overall with everybody there right before leaving?
You know, it was serious. I know I keep using the word apprehensive, but it just fits so well.
Right.
You know, and it was, you know, it was strange. You met that it was a deployment stop for the Army, but it was also a place where you came back into the States. When you came back from Vietnam, in fact, that's where, when I came back from Vietnam, I came back through Fort Lewis, and every once in a while you'd run into some guys who had been here, and I mean, they wouldn't really talk to you.
Right.
Yeah, they just, you know, had this look like they'd been there, done that, and really didn't want to have very much to do with the guys that were going over, it didn't seem.
Really? Did you all want to talk and ask, you know, what can we expect? How was it? Or did you?
I think that they would have thought our questions were stupid.
Yeah. Well, so tell me about the flight over. What was that like?
I really don't remember much of the flight over. I just, you know, remember getting on the plane, and I basically remember landing. I must have, I don't know, maybe I slept a lot on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember that we had one stop. We stopped in Guam and refueled and had some lunch or dinner there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're there for probably a couple hours, and then we're back on the plane, and next thing I knew, we were in landing in Cameron Bay.
Wow. Now, you had heard of Cameron Bay, I assume,
yes,
beforehand.
Yeah.
What did it look like from the air? Was it at night or in the morning? Or?
No, it was day. I think it was about midday.
Okay.
Do
you remember what it looked like?
Yeah, I remember flying over it and seeing the beach and the ocean, and then heading a little inland, as I remember, and landing on the tarmac. I guess I remember more about landing than anything,
mm-hmm.
because we all remember talking to guys thinking, well, you know, we're unarmed.
I mean, you were really thinking that
yeah,
we're right. Landing in a war and we don't have weapons.
I don't have a weapon anywhere near me, because you have no expectation of what it's going to be like when you land there, and
uh-huh.
As far as we all knew, you know, as soon as we get off the plane, we're going to start getting shot at.
Right.
But that didn't turn out to be the case. I mean, it was a huge base, and then we came down off of the plane, and got onto some buses, and headed over to an area where you kind of checked in.
Mm-hmm.
You handed them your orders, and they gave you other orders, and got you situated for the first couple days you were there.
Mm-hmm. Did you remember what it felt like when you stepped off the plane onto the tarmac? I mean, what were your first impressions of the country itself?
That it was very hot, very muggy, and it smelled weird.
What did it smell like?
Well, kind of a cross between what I had smelled in Guam, I guess, in terms of the tropics, and I got my first whiff of burning human excrement.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is that?
Uh-huh.
And then people tell you, you go, you're kidding.
the shit patrol.
The shit patrol.
Yeah.
They'd set up outhouses around and with they'd cut up oil drums and sit them under the toilet seat, and then somebody would have the duty of pulling those oil drums full of shit out once or twice a day, and they'd pour kerosene and mix it in and set it on fire. Because I guess the ground wasn't very conducive to building any kind of sewer system, and if you tried to dig some type of what's the term I'm searching for?
A trench or a hole?
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't dig it very deep because I think the water would burble up.
Uh-huh.
The Cameron Bay was probably 5 feet above sea level.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to deal with it some way, so they burnt it.
So you get your you check in, you stay there for, what'd you say, a day or so?
I think I was in Cameron Bay for about 4 or 5 days.
Okay.
I think that's right.
Okay. What were you waiting on?
I was waiting on orders of where I was going to go. I mean, that was kind of a, I hadn't been. That's where they decide what unit you're going to go into.
Okay.
And it could be really anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked a couple of days of guard duty in Cameron Bay. Mm-hmm. I remember they gave me to walk guard duty. They gave me an M1 rifle.
Wow.
I'd never fired or seen an M1 rifle until they handed me one that day. I'd always trained with an M16. I'm going, what the hell am I going to do with this thing?
Yeah. This was your first weapon issue?
Yes.
Okay. Did they tell you how to walk guard duty, or did they just
you'd been trained in walking guard duty. We walked a lot of guard duty in basic and AIT, and I was just walking a perimeter inside of a perimeter. So it wasn't like I was walking the very outside of the perimeter.
Right.
I think it gave me that duty, give us something to do more than anything else. Keep us out of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Any incidents, anything happened during
those
few days?
No.
Okay. Did you hear the war going on?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I don't think the whole time I was there, I don't think I heard one siren. I don't remember any incoming. Just remember being very sunburnt.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I was pretty much raised in the north.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never, it gets hot and muggy in Indiana and upstate New York and in Delaware, but nothing like the tropics of Vietnam.
Right.
And, when I went to basic training in South Carolina, it was started in September, so I went there mostly during the fall. But, man, it took some getting used to the heat and humidity.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, when you finally got your orders, which unit were you assigned to, and where did you go?
I was assigned to Charlie Company,
mm-hmm.
the 5th of the 46th mm-hmm. Battalion, 198th Brigade, and the AmeriCal Division.
Okay. And where did they send you?
They sent me to Chulai.
Okay.
And I took a, I'm sure, I don't remember that, but I'm sure I took some type of airplane, transport, sea, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. What was Chulai like?
Smaller version of Cameron Bay. It was right on the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
The area really, as I look back on it, was really a beautiful area. There were mountains to the west and white sandy beach coastline, but the base, was surrounded by barbed wire and
mm-hmm.
and lots of bunkers and looked like a army base, and I think there was a I don't know if it was the Marines or the Navy had a squadron of fighters there, and there were some other aircraft there as well.
Okay.
I think that's correct.
Was this your permanent base, or how long were you there?
I was only there briefly. to kind of sign into the battalion, and then I guess into the went to the company headquarters there at the base, and I mean, in pretty quick order. I don't even know if I was there a night. I was on a deuce and a half, mm-hmm. Heading down Highway 1 to somewhere near, I've forgotten if it was Bayonet or Gator, mm-hmm. To meet up with the company. I think I spent a couple, I don't remember if it was Gator or Bayonet,
mm-hmm.
But I spent a couple nights there waiting for the company to come in, and that's when I first saw some incoming.
Mm-hmm.
We got mortared that night, and there were dinks in the wire,
mm-hmm.
and that was pretty exciting.
tell me about the mortar experience. I mean, is this your first kind of taste of the war?
Yeah. I mean, it's just. You could hear the thunk of the mortar round coming out of the tube,
mm-hmm.
and you knew what it was because you'd heard that sound in back in the States when you were training, and
mm-hmm.
who knew where it was going to drop? And that's where everybody just kind of, you know, at least I was the first time out, kind of holding my breath.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I soon learned that the Vietnamese weren't very good shots with those things. But they did manage to get a couple rounds inside the base that night,
mm-hmm.
and I know that they had a couple of VC in the wire.
Right.
There were I think they got off one satchel,
mm-hmm.
of explosives at some bunker someplace, but I don't remember anybody getting hurt.
Well, from there, what happened? Where did you go?
From there, I got on another truck and headed up the road a few more miles, and there was my company standing on the side of the road of Highway 1. And so I got put in a squad and a platoon and a squad, and we humped down the road about probably a couple clicks down this trail, and set up a perimeter for the evening, and off we went.
Steve, how did the company receive you? What was it like when you stepped off the truck and walked over and joined them?
Everybody was I thought pretty quiet but friendly. Welcome aboard. There was a sergeant that kind of took me under his wing. He'd been there for a while. His name was Olson, as I remember. He was from, I think, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
He said, kind of stick close to me for the first few days here until you figure out what's going on. And that was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I
imagine that made you feel a little bit better.
Yeah, a little better, yeah. But, you know, I had somebody watching out for me that I didn't do something stupid the first few days I was there.
Mm-hmm. I assume you were issued your M16 at this point.
Yeah, M16, and I was carrying a couple hand grenades, and everybody was assigned in a squad to carry an ammunition belt for the M60.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and canteens, and you know, the rest of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My own. I think I had two or three bandoliers of ammunition for my M16. And I probably was carrying, I know off and on I did a Claymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody kind of divvied stuff out, so it was pretty much evenly weighted throughout the squad.
Did it make you carry more since you were new?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
God, I couldn't have carried any more.
What did that weigh, all that stuff together?
I don't know. I guess it probably weighed around 65 pounds, something like that.
Wow.
It's one of the things, you know, people ask me, I said, well, what was it like to be in the infantry and to be a, you know, out in the field, and I said, well, it was a lot of a very hard physical work,
mm-hmm.
Because you're carrying around this 65-pound rucksack and carrying a weapon, and during those days they made you wear a flak jacket and a steel pot,
mm-hmm.
and it was probably 92 degrees and 95% humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time, if you especially in the Batangan Peninsula where I first was, you try to stay off the trails, which means you were walking in rice paddies.
Mm-hmm.
So you were up to your knees in mud with all this weight on you. So it's just, I'd never, I played high school football, two-a-day workouts,
mm-hmm.
Worked in some construction, I'd done some hard work, but I'd never worked this hard carrying this much weight through that much crap in all my life.
Mm-hmm. Was it a shock to your system there at first?
Yeah, I really, I thought, a couple times I was straggling a little bit behind the squad, and I'm beginning to think, Jesus, I don't know if I'm going to make this.
Mm-hmm.
But you get acclimated, and I guess you get toughened up, and, you're just one of those, you do what you have to do. And I don't know that you ever get used to it, but you get better at it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What else were you carrying besides your weapons and ammo and your steel pot and flak jacket? What else did you have with you?
Oh, I know I had a bayonet. What else? Some personal belongings. Not very many. A wallet, and I carried a couple quarts of water.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember really anything else.
Okay. I assume a relatively new uniform.
Yeah. The standard poncho liner.
Mm-hmm.
That everybody used as a blanket at night and as a tent during the day if you were stopped down for something, and it's a way to put a couple sticks and hook it up as a little lean-to tent and get out of the sun.
Mm-hmm. What about food rations?
God. I guess I was probably carrying probably one day of rations. I really don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I must have been, though, because you didn't get resupplied every day.
Right.
I remember carrying water more than I remember carrying rations.
Okay. How fast would you go through your water?
Well, you'd really, that's the thing. I would try to, and some guys carried less than I did, and I don't know how they did that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were really out humping a lot during the day, I tried not to drink more than a quart during the day, and save a quart so I could really replenish. At night,
right?
And when you stop down at night, we usually find some place where we could fill up the canteens and throw a lot of tablets in them.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it taste like shit, but
right.
You still have water.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the first few days. What were you feeling? You got the sergeant who's helping you out. Did you stick right by his side? And
well, I wasn't right by his side, but I was no more than one guy away from him.
Right.
Usually following him, and I was just doing a lot of. We were working the area that was kind of out near My Lai,
mm-hmm.
Which is heavily heavily mined, lots of VC.
Mm-hmm.
We were on patrol and during the day and at night. Certain squads would go out and set up ambushes or listening posts at night. I didn't have to go do it. I didn't go out at night for the first few weeks. I don't think that I was there.
Because they didn't allow you?
Yeah, I think they spared me that.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things were they telling you, Steve? You said the first night you guys kind of, when you hooked up with them, you went out, you dug in for the night, you set up a defensive perimeter. And I mean, what were they saying? Now, here's what you need to be doing, here's what you don't need to be doing. Or were they just not talking, or were they saying just watch and learn?
Well, you know, I guess they would tell you where to dig your foxhole, you know, how to set up your line of fire. But I already pretty much knew that from AIT.
Mm-hmm.
There were, you know, a lot of it was, you know, the importance if you're on guard duty in that foxhole is the importance of staying awake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't be smoking cigarettes. At night, no radios. You know, a lot of guys had radios in the field, and they'd plug in an earphone.
Mm-hmm.
If you got caught doing that, I mean, you're in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, things like that, I guess.
Right.
You know how to, you know, not be afraid if you. If you really think that there's something out there, and you see something, don't be afraid to fire off that claymore.
Mm-hmm.
And once you did that, you could be assured everybody was going to be alive and awake and after it.
Okay.
Did
you ever have to do that early on, or you were?
No.
Okay.
No. I remember the first, I think I was in the field like 3 or 4 days, and the first time that we got attacked, we had set up for a perimeter in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just about, it was heading towards dark, twilight, and VC must have gotten close to our perimeter and threw two or three grenades into the middle of the our perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody ducked down and headed for the foxholes, and we just kind of recon by fire for about 30 seconds or so. And I remember my sergeant saying to me, "Well, congratulations, you just got your CIB."
What was your reaction?
I said I did. I think I laughed with him.
Uh-huh. What was that first taste of combat like?
Well, you know, it's just confusion. Because when something like that happens, everybody kind of, or at least I did, you just, you know, the hair on the back of your head goes straight up, and, I guess I probably froze for a second or so and trying to figure out, okay, what do I do? And then you're looking for that foxhole,
mm-hmm.
the place where you're supposed to be setting up that defensive position.
Mm-hmm.
And I after you go through that the first time and you react the way you are supposed to react, that's somewhat of getting a little bit of getting a monkey off your back.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never know how you're going to react to it until it happens.
Right.
And then once you see yourself react accordingly or the way you're supposed to, you feel a little better. You go, okay, I guess I know what I'm doing, or I know a little bit about what I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Were you pleased with the way you reacted?
I guess. I think it built my confidence level a little bit. I don't know if please, but it was a confidence builder.
Right. Well, Steve, tell me after our first few days, you said, out in the field.
Right.
This happened. Describe for me what a typical day was like for you when you're out there in the field doing this. What would you all do?
Well, the first month I was out there was you'd be up, you know, in the morning, you know, at, you know, just as the sun is coming up. I mean, that's when everybody's getting up and getting after it. You'd be almost every day. We'd be on a patrol, some type of sweep or some type of search and destroy mission.
Was it company size or platoon size?
Sometimes it was company size. Sometimes it was platoon size.
Okay.
The only time we really operated as a squad was we came upon something and you wanted to check something out a few hundred yards away, you'd send out a squad of guys and have them report back on radio and then or come back into the platoon or company strength.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd send out a squad of guys on a night ambush.
Mm-hmm.
But daytime missions were usually in platoon or company wise. Batangan Peninsula was, you know, I think I said earlier, just full of VC.
Mm-hmm.
It was heavily, heavily mined. I mean, we found mines every day. We had guys, it seemed like every few days we'd have somebody wounded by who had hit a mine. Some of them, most of them weren't all that serious, but enough that they'd have to be sent back to the rear.
Mm-hmm. How did you look?
So everybody was just, I mean, very uptight, nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Getting angry.
What do you mean?
Well, you'd run into these, you'd come into these villages, and you'd just see, you'd see men and or you'd see women and children and old men. You wouldn't see any men between the ages of probably 15 and 50.
Okay.
So you knew it was a VC village, and you knew that these people were. What was happening at night was very much different than what was happening in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
This was the same area of operation of Lieutenant Callie.
Yes.
So we were feeling the same frustration as his. As his troopers were, I mean, mm-hmm. we were handling it a lot better than I think than he did.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of tension and apprehension and frustration in dealing with the people out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't understand tactically why we'd let this go on. Why wouldn't we just take all these folks, gather them up, get them back to the rear, ascertain whether they were good guys or bad guys, and then let us go through this area in a sweep and assume that anybody that was left out there were bad guys?
Mm-hmm. Would you all talk about that? Or is this something on reflection?
Yeah, I think we used to talk about that. How we would... it was part of the frustration with we knew they were VC, and yet we weren't allowed to do anything about it in many cases.
Would you search the village?
Sure. You'd find tunnels, and sometimes, not often, but every once in a while, we'd find some ammunition, and
mm-hmm.
we'd fire that up.
Tell me how you search a village. I mean, like, you walk in the main road, and what happens? Or what you guys did, how you all did it—not necessarily the textbook way, but just how it happened for you.
If you come across the village and you'd just been shot at, and somebody had disappeared back towards this village, you'd come on the village. You'd do it. You'd be coming up in a single file up to the village, and then you'd spread out, so you'd kind of sweep through it online, if you would, and with pushing all the people in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So you get them all into one spot. So you'd have some control then.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want anybody behind you. And then you'd start going through the hooches and seeing what was in there. And sometimes you didn't find anything. You'd just find food or tools, supplies, those kinds of things, you know, for farming the rice paddies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, every once in a while you'd find some tunnel that led to who knows where.
You wouldn't go down in it?
Well, we had some tunnel rats. I remember this one guy. I mean, I thought he was absolutely nuts to go down there, but you'd hand him a .45 and he'd crawl down in there. More often than not, he'd bring out something, you know, some satchel charge or AK-47 or a bunch of unexploded mortars or something.
Mm-hmm. What happened when you'd find things like this? You suspected the village was VC, but now you've got some proof that they're doing something against you.
I don't ever remember burning a village down in the Batangan Peninsula. I remember burning one up in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Later, a few months later. But we would, you know, as I recall, we would, you know, if we found the weapons, we'd take them back, or we'd get somebody from ordnance to blow them up, or we'd attempt. You know, and sometimes the ordnance would come in behind us and attempt to blow up the tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes, you know, depending on what we found, we would round up some people in the village and send them back to the rear for questioning.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, beyond that, it's, you know, kind of hazy what would happen.
What was morale like during your first few weeks there? And did that change?
Well, I don't think it was high because everybody was so tense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of ticked at how this whole you know, operation was going. So it was, you know, there was kind of a disgruntled spirit, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, you know, a lot of that was caused by, you know, if every two or three days or so somebody in the unit was getting wounded, you know, guys would get, you know, they'd be more fearful. They're going to be the next guy to step on a mine. They'd be ticked that their friend had got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nobody to shoot at. To retaliate against.
Right. Was there, I hear this myth, people hear this myth of, you know, you didn't get close to new guys, first of all, because they, you know, didn't know what they were doing and they likely would get killed or hurt quicker. But tell me how bonds formed. And was that myth true?
I think there is a little bit of truth to it. In the first few days that you're there, I think, I think people are kind of wanting to know who this guy is. They want to know that you're going to have your act together and you're not going to be some kind of jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Or cause them to get hurt. But once people figure out that you halfway have your act together,
mm-hmm.
and it really doesn't, in my mind, I don't think it took that long to get acclimated to the process, you know. Within a week or two, you know, I thought I had a pretty good, you know, relationship with most of the guys in my squad and with the other squads in the platoon.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there's a little truth to that, but I think it's exaggerated. I mean, if on the other hand, and I saw this happen, you get somebody who comes out to the squad or comes out to the platoon, and this guy's dumber than a rock, or, you know, just has no common sense, you're, A, trying to stay away from him, and, B, you're trying to get him sent back to the rear.
Oh, yeah. How would you get that done?
call the first sergeant and tell him to get his ass out of here. Find him a rear job someplace.
And that was, you were able to get that done?
Yeah, I saw that happen a couple of times. It didn't get done by me, but it got done by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either, you know, one of the squad sergeants, you know, would call the top sergeant back at the rear and, you know, and say, man, you know, who are you sending us here?
Right.
Get him out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen very often, but I saw it happen a couple times
mm-hmm.
during the, I don't know, five, six, however many months I was out in the field.
Mm-hmm. What were those relationships like overall for you while you were there out in the field? I mean, is that the most important thing motivating you, or is it the policy of the United States, or is it your own survival?
Well, I think that, you know, your own survival is dependent upon the survival of the squad, the survival of the platoon. And I don't know if Vietnam was any different than any other war, you know, and some of the stuff I've read, you know, you fight for each other as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your supplies. Were you able to get adequate supplies and resupplied when you needed it, or did you ever have to go without for a while?
I think there were a couple of times where for whatever reason the Hueys were grounded and there were, we might not get resupplied for like a day past or 2 days past when we would normally get resupplied.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't ever remember anything more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Other than one time when we were pinned down in a valley out west of Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had all kinds of problems.
Okay. Well,
but the worst part of the Batangan Peninsula was walking the minefields and then, you know, either being mortared every night, or I remember one night we had a number of a pretty big rocket attack on the company.
Mm-hmm.
That really that was the only night that while I was out in the Batangan Peninsula where some of those rounds from the rockets really got close.
To you or to your squad?
Well, they got inside the perimeter, and it was close enough where it shook the earth. I mean, I was down in a hole in the ground, and that hole was like about an equivalent of a 6 or 7 on the Richter scale.
Wow. I can only imagine that was a bit scary.
And everybody was scared that night, and we had dinks on the wire. And we had a number of kills, I think, that night. Them, not us. And everybody was pretty ticked off the next morning.
At the enemy?
At the enemy.
Yeah. And when you were ticked off, did you want to, you know, go out?
Well, you wanted them to stand and fight, but in typical, you know, guerrilla warfare, I mean, their tactics were just the opposite, and I understood that.
Did everybody else?
For them to stand and fight, they were going to get hurt.
Right. Did you all understand that?
I don't know if everybody understood that, but I, you know, had read enough, you know, American history to know that, you know, the Americans were successful a lot because, you know, they hid behind the trees and shot at the guys in the red coats.
Right.
You know, that wasn't always the case in every battle in the American Revolution, but it was, but it frustrated the hell out of the British in
mm-hmm.
a lot of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understood the tactics that the VC were trying to use. You know, you had to work hard to try to flush them out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure everybody in the unit understood that, but, you know, talking to some guys, you know, that were there at the time, you know, there were guys that knew what was going on in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Steve, tell me about the mines. You said this was, you know, perhaps the biggest problem, something you encountered every day. It was a constant threat. How would you find a mine? What did you look for?
Well, I didn't. You're looking for. I didn't walk a lot. I didn't walk any point out on the Matangan Peninsula.
Why not?
Well, I was a still a what an FNG.
Uh-huh. And they didn't quite trust you out there.
No, most of the guys had been who were walking point had been out in the bush for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, I think that there was some trust built up. I had their trust, but I didn't have their trust enough that you're going to put somebody who'd only been in country a few weeks out walking point.
Right.
That this wasn't going to happen. It would be stupid on their part, and it would be stupid on my part to even think about doing that.
Mm-hmm. Did these point walkers, did they volunteer for this, or were they assigned?
No, most of them, I think, kind of accepted the position, I guess is the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't remember when I did walk point volunteering for it, but I just thought that I was probably the best person for it.
Okay. Go ahead and tell me then about the mines, locating them.
There are two guys really that are walking point. There's one guy who's out in front and he's looking down, and the guy behind is looking out.
Uh-huh.
All right, so the guy who's looking down is looking at the trail, looking at where he's putting his feet, looking for something that's out of order, something that doesn't belong, or something that looks like it's just been moved,
mm-hmm.
or looking for a tripwire.
Now, these are on trails? Were you out actually?
Yeah, but mines are almost, you know, always on trails, which is why, you know, if you get to a point where you're going, geez, I mean, we're in the middle of a minefield, get the hell off the trail and, mm-hmm. and get out into either the bush and cut your way through it, or get out into the rice paddies and walk through the rice paddies.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way, there's not really an easy way to set up a mine in a rice paddy.
Right.
But that made it a lot tougher going. And you weren't going to get to where you were supposed to be and maybe the time you were supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you could, you tried to walk the trail. If it got impossible to walk the trail, you got off the trail and walked the rice paddies.
Okay. So these two, are they within sight of you guys? Are they that far out where you can't see them?
Oh, no, they're within sight.
Okay.
I mean, I'd say the next guy behind them is probably 15 yards, 20 yards. And these guys are probably, the one looking at the ground, and then the next guy is probably, 10 feet behind him.
Okay. I would imagine that's a pretty hairy task.
Yeah, that's a little hairy.
Yeah.
And the hairiest spot I ever saw with regard to mines was out in the Batangan Peninsula.
Yeah.
I mean, it ran into mines every place else, but nothing like what was out there.
You're talking about one, what, every 100 yards or at least one a day?
Oh, there at least one a day. I mean, sometimes there would be, it would seem like every, you know, and I wasn't up walking point, but I, you know, you remember stopping and everybody would, you know, stand still. It means we found something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, you know, it might happen, you know, several times in an hour.
Right.
And at that point, you know, you start saying, okay, we're probably going to get off the trail here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to hump this damn thing through a rice paddy.
I can see where you all would get pretty pissed off at the enemy.
Yeah.
You want to say, okay, whoever's making us do this, I want to take them out.
And it's hot as hell, and uh-huh. it's just, you know, you're tired, and, you know, you've been up half the night,
mm-hmm.
Every night that you're out there. And so, the you know, sleep deprivation is just kind of normal.
Mm-hmm. What keeps you going? I mean, what in that kind of situation, what keeps you going? instead of saying, you know, the hell with this, I just can't do it anymore.
Well, it's not like you have a lot of choice.
Right. But civilians listening to this, they're going to be like, my God, I mean, that just sounds like hell on earth.
Well, you're in the Army. You're under orders.
Mm-hmm.
There's guys around you who are depending on you. And I know that sounds a little hokey, but that's how it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because I've never been so dependent on a group of people, a group of guys, as in my life. I mean, with the exception of my wife, and mm-hmm. then those guys who you fought with in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. The injuries from the mines, were these mainly from the two up front, or could it be someone back in the line?
Mostly up in the front. You know, occasionally, the point guys would miss something,
mm-hmm.
or it would be something that was slightly off the trail, and somebody that's what you tried to do when you were. As you were following these guys, you try to almost follow in their footsteps,
mm-hmm.
and narrow the path as much as you could.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you got off 2 feet or 3 feet to the right, there was something that they missed,
mm-hmm.
and somebody would hit that, and an explosion would happen. And I saw that happen a couple of times, but I don't remember any more than that. It didn't
mm-hmm.
happen very often.
Okay. Tell me about the basic differences between the daytime and nighttime. You hear all this stuff about that they rule the night and you guys rule the day. I mean, what was the actual reality of the situation there?
I don't know that I would say that they ruled the night, but some of the advantages that we had, we lost during the night. The odds evened more at night. Let me put it that way.
Okay. How so?
Well, because the loss of sight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really really that simple. And they did know the area better than we knew it.
Mm-hmm.
So we took a more defensive posture at night, and they, you know, the only time that they could take the offense was at night.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of one time that I was there, but in my mind, even though they were taking the offense, they were up against some pretty pretty solid forces that were dug in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as many times as you hear about VC and they got inside the compound and so on and so forth. I mean, most times, you know, when they did that, they weren't very successful. They ended up being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of damage that they did versus, you know, the amount of lives that they lost, you know, I was never in a situation where I saw the VC or the NVA win a skirmish, with the exception of one time, and I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the rear when my squad got overrun.
We'll save that and talk about that
yeah.
when we have a little bit more time. Let me ask you a couple of just basic questions
okay.
that people want to know about the war and want to know about. You know, it's either the stuff is either perpetuated by movies, by books, or just rumor. Tell me about fragging. Was that ever discussed? Did you ever see it, witness it, hear about it?
About
fragging.
Fragging.
Yes.
You're talking about fellow soldiers?
Fellow soldiers killing officers. Because of, you know, whatever, personal reasons or or professional stuff. You know, just I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go back out there the next day and this guy's going to make me, so I'm gonna take him out. That's a basic scenario.
I remember being talked about a couple of times, but I don't ever remember it ever happening.
When it was talked about, what was it? Just more of a joke, or
no? It was. It was. You'd be pretty pissed off at either your at a sergeant that you know, or at a lieutenant or captain who was who you felt was out to make a name for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Who was more gung-ho than he was smart.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know this for sure, but I remember having a conversation about how some lieutenant, and it wasn't in our company, but it was in one of the other companies in the battalion, I guess, woke up in the morning with a, you know, with a hand grenade, you know, and down at the bottom of his poncho liner.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's what I heard
as a message.
As a message.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about tension between those who were, you know, enlisted and maybe career military, the officers or even the lower ranks, and between those who were drafted? Did you see any tension there, any problems?
No. You know, maybe there was some in the rear, but once you got to the field, all of that disappeared in a hurry.
Yeah.
I thought I had good relationships and with my platoon lieutenant, who later became company commander, and most of the sergeants that were my squad leader, with the exception of one.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that those guys all pretty much had their act together and were pretty good leaders.
Okay. What about tension between those in the field and those in the rear?
Yeah, well, we saw some of that.
tell me about that. you know, Steve, that's almost a positive answer almost every time.
It's, we were in almost in a riot. We came back to the rear on a 3-day stand down after being out in the field for I don't know how many weeks. You know, you lose track.
Mm-hmm.
But we were tired and weary and wanted some beer and steaks. And I mean, we had just gotten back. We'd only been there for about a day. And a couple of our guys were over at the EM club.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of racial tension in the rear as well. Anyway, our guys were, and I was back catching a nap at the hooch, and I got woken up by a couple guys from my squad and said, "What's going on?" And they said, "Well, I've forgotten his name. Just got the shit kicked out of him by a bunch of black guys in the EM club." I said, "What'd they do that for?" And he goes, "Because they can." So here's a, you know,
this was a racial thing, or
this was a racial thing.
Oh, okay.
And when I got a rear job, I saw a lot of that. But anyway, here's a whole company of infantry guys that just come down on stand down, and they take your weapons away from you when you come in, or you lose all your ammunition because officers don't want to be fired on by the grunts. So, you know, we didn't have any, you know, we didn't have any guns or anything or any to take over there. We would have fired on these guys, I'm sure. So we're taking apart the cots, and we're on our way in force, headed over to the EM club.
Uh-huh.
And they're about 20 other guys standing there waiting for us. And the MPs show up in a deuce and a half and start waving their nightsticks around.
Uh-huh.
And managed to get us corralled and back to our quarters on the beach there. And then, I mean, they turned right around and said, hook them up, guys. You're heading back out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They're going to get rid of you.
Well, they took us. We got suited up and got all our gear, and the helicopters were out on the pad within an hour and a half, and we were back in the field.
Wow. Now, was that planned, or was that in
the result? I think they wanted us out of there because we were going to hurt some people.
Yeah.
We were going to – you just don't fuck with a guy who's come out of the field.
Right. And the guys who beat up your friend – they were rear personnel, or were
they? Were rear personnel. Yeah, they were rems.
Okay. Okay.
And it's probably a good thing they sent us back to the field because we would have found them and hurt them.
This was July?
This was July.
Okay, and this is what, in 1970 still?
Yep.
Okay.
This is all 1970.
Yeah.
You're going to ask me what month, and sometime between March and August.
No, actually, I'm not going to ask you month because I know that's hard to remember.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about the racism in the rear when you were in the field, that part of your tour. How was that?
I didn't see any racism in the field. And we had black guys in our unit, and they were all good soldiers. One of them was a medic. All good, straight, tough guys.
Uh-huh.
It was when you got back to the rear that you saw the racial issues.
Why was that?
Some of it had to do with what was going on back in the States. It was a reflection of that.
Mm-hmm.
The black guys tended to hang out together.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of black power salutes.
Mm-hmm.
They would attempt to intimidate white guys.
How would they do that?
Well, just by getting in your face, trying to start a fight. I played when I got my rear job, and I like to play basketball. I mm-hmm. played a lot of basketball in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
Had played a lot in Sandlot, growing up in New York, and oftentimes on a basketball court, if you're playing and something didn't go their way. I mean, you'd find two or three of these guys in your face.
Hmm. That sounds like it's really tightly wound.
It was. I mean, it was very. You really, in my mind, had to be careful where you were at night in the rear.
Really?
Much like walking around in some cities. In the United States, where there were certain neighborhoods that you just didn't want to be in at night.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of feeling.
That's incredible. And you're all there. What are the black when they did the black power salute? Was that an insult? Did you all take
yeah,
it that
well,
way?
Well, it was an insult and it was a threat.
Uh-huh.
I took it as a threat.
Okay.
And I really didn't understand why the officer corps didn't shut this stuff down.
Were there black officers?
Not a whole lot. I can remember a couple, but that's all.
Okay. Why do you think the officers didn't deal with it?
Maybe they were intimidated by it, too. Maybe they felt that politically, if they tried to step in, they'd have a bigger problem than what they had.
Mm-hmm. How often did you go back, when you were in the field, how often did you go back to the rear to rest up?
Oh, jeez. Not enough. I guess you'd be out in the field like, 3-4 weeks. And then you come back for like a 3-day stand down.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go back out again. I think that's right, but I...
Yeah. Right, give or take.
Give or take.
Do you remember any other incidents, any racial incidents besides this one? You talk about the Black Power salutes. Anything happened to you personally?
No, other, guys get in my face, and, I was always the kind of guy, I didn't back down from much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess once somebody sees that you're not going to intimidate this person, they kind of leave you alone.
Mm-hmm.
The group dynamics were, different than the individual,
mm-hmm.
It just seemed like if the black guys would get in a group, they would just get more full of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is
that true for you all as well?
Yeah, I don't think so. There were some guys in and around that would use the N word, but not very many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about anybody else, but I always try to discourage that. I mean, what do you want to do that for? What do you want to light that match for?
Right. Were there any people straddling the fence? Any black guys, white guys who were friends with both sides, or had a
well,
friend?
Well, like I said, the guys who I served with in the field that were black, they weren't that way at all.
Really?
Yeah. It was always the guys in the rear, the guys who were working, the black guys working on the motor pool, or they were cooks or
mm-hmm.
Clerks or. Well, not so much the clerical people either. If you were a clerk in a brigade or battalion headquarters, or even a company headquarters, I don't think that you would get away with that.
Right. The black guys in the field with you, they acted when they came back to the rear. They acted differently.
No, they hung around with us.
Really?
They hung around with the company.
Right. Well, Steve, why don't we go ahead and stop for today? We're right at our time limit.
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Stephen Dant. I am again in Lubbock, Texas. Today is April 20th, 2005. It's approximately 8:22 a.m. Central Standard Time. And, Steve, you are in Colorado Springs again. Why don't we pick up where we left off last time in our conversation? Basically, was covering what your typical day was like and what some of your activities were. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about your equipment and some of the things you carried with you in the field, if you want to pick up there, Steve.
Sure. Well, what I think I said last time, we were talking about a couple of the basics, and one of those was amount of water that you carried. I mean, it was very, very hot there, very humid.
Yes.
And I carried two containers of water. One was this bladder thing, I think held like 2 quarts. Of water, and then I also carried a standard canteen on my belt.
Okay.
And I tried to drink as little as I possibly could during the day and then really replenish, as you kind of standing down in the evening or otherwise you were just, you had to replenish water during the day, but you were losing it probably as fast as you were putting it in your body.
were you able to get resupply of water, or were you filling up your canteens in the streams and using your
fish? Mostly, especially out on the Batangan Peninsula, we were filling it up and wherever we could find it, and dropping in, which, you know, sometimes was even rice paddy water,
mm-hmm.
And then dropping in a lot of whatever the tablets were,
mm-hmm.
That would hopefully sterilize in some fashion the water, so make it drinkable. It never tasted very good, but at least you didn't get sick from it.
Right. Did you have people in your unit who had problems with water rationing and making sure they were careful about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I carried as much or more water than anybody in the squad and maybe in the platoon. There were other guys that just carried a couple of canteens and seemed like they were always thirsty. And well, you learned really not to, I mean, share your water, or you were going to be in as much trouble as they were. And mm-hmm. they just had to either learn to conserve or carry more water.
So you guys didn't ask each other for water very often?
No, that just wasn't done. I mean, you carried what you needed, and, it was one thing to bum a cigarette off of somebody, but it was another thing to ask somebody for somebody else's water.
Right.
And it was the same thing with ammunition. I mean, I carried 3 bandoliers of, I carried an M16 rifle, so I carried like 3 bandoliers
with the ammunition for the
M16? Yeah, the ammunition, of clips of ammunition. I think there were 7 or 8 clips of ammunition in each bandolier.
Mm-hmm.
And those were, you know, a couple wrapped around my belt and one wrapped around my shoulder. Most guys carried 2. But I just always felt like I was always afraid that I did not want to run out of ammunition.
You wanted to have as much as possible.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense in a war zone to kind of be ready for that.
But it makes for a heavier pack.
Sure. Did your equipment function properly, starting with your M16?
Yeah, for the most part.
Okay.
I mean, I really didn't get some of the stories that I was reading about the, you know, negative stories about the M16. I never had a problem. Never had the weapon not fire when I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it was, if it was taken care of and it was sighted properly, it was a very accurate weapon. So I never had an incident where a pin came out of a hand grenade when it wasn't supposed to, or even I never even saw any of M60 machine gun always worked fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought our equipment was, we were in pretty good shape.
Okay. Tell me about your weapons in general. You had your M16.
Right.
How about a .45? Did you carry that?
No, I didn't.
Nothing? Okay. What else did you carry with you as far as weapons are concerned?
I remember I carried a knife. I don't know if it was a bayonet or not. It could have been a bayonet. I carried usually a couple of hand grenades.
Mm-hmm.
The other weaponry was kind of divided amongst the squad. You know, if you weren't carrying a belt of M60 ammunition, then you were probably carrying a couple claymores.
Okay.
Or maybe a few extra rounds for the guy who was carrying the M79.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was that expected for you all to kind of pick up the load for those?
Yeah, it was kind of divvied up. When I first got in country, the squad leader kind of handed you the stuff that you were going to carry. Once you got in country for a while, you just kind of understood that, you know, you're carrying this, I'm carrying this, you guys are carrying that. I mean, it's just kind of automatically divvied up. And I would bet you that it came within a half a pound in terms of weight division amongst the squad in terms of evening it out.
So everything was kind of distributed equally.
By weight.
Yeah, you pulled your own share.
Right.
Were you ordered to do that, or is that something you all just did on your own?
Well, it was. It could have been ordered. I mean, it would have been ordered, but I never heard an order to that effect. It mm-hmm. was just done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was your favorite weapon?
The M16.
Why is that?
You
already said it was accurate.
Well, yeah, it was accurate. I felt like next to the, I guess, M60, and I mean, well, I guess I felt like that I could react a lot quicker with an M16 to anything that was going on than any other weapon I could be carrying.
Okay.
And I did feel like it was accurate. I felt like I could turn and fire or be on the ground and fire with a great deal of accuracy in a hurry mm-hmm. if I had to. And that wasn't the case if you're necessarily, I guess if you're carrying an M79, a grenade launcher, but you couldn't spray ammunition with an M79 the way you could with an M16.
Right.
And an M60 took a lot longer to get going. Besides, I wasn't the biggest guy in the squad, and I wasn't, you know, that usually was assigned to the biggest guy in the squad because it was a pretty heavy weapon to carry, but it took a little while to get that weapon going.
Right, right. What would you say was the most feared weapon?
From the enemy?
Yes.
Probably RPGs, at least in my case. Mm-hmm. Man, those things come at you, and maybe because I've been under a couple of attacks where a couple of them have come pretty close.
Mm-hmm. What's it like for an RPG round to be shot at you?
The first one I remember, it was at night, and you could kind of hear it coming in, and I didn't realize what it was at first, but once you hear one, you know what the hell it is the next time.
Mm-hmm. What does it sound like? I mean, is it very distinct?
I just remember seeing a flash of light and whistling through the air.
Okay.
And then, you know, the explosion hits with a thud, and it's actually bigger, I think, than the grenade itself is bigger than a hand grenade. So mm-hmm. it seemed like a bigger explosive going off, and it caused a lot of damage in the surrounding area.
Mm-hmm.
And if you aren't well fortified or underground a good piece, I mean, you're going to get hurt.
Right. Okay.
I've been close enough where it's, you know, literally, shook the ground and knocked stuff over in my trench, and I mean, just felt like the trench was going to come down inside on top of me.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we talk about the enemy a little bit? Tell me what your general impressions were of who you were facing in the field.
Well, I faced two different enemy in the field, and when I first was in country, it was almost all Viet Cong, and they were, you know, guerrilla warriors. I mean, they were, I don't know where they were in the daytime. I never saw a man over probably the age of 14 under the age of, it was hard to tell how old they were, but mm-hmm. under the age of 50 during the day. If you go through the villages, it was all mama-sans and kids, baby-sans.
Right.
And they were good at it. I mean, they knew the terrain. They knew, you know, they were operating where they lived. I mean, they knew how to put together booby traps and mine the trails and attack and disappear at night, and good at ambushing at night. So you really had to be had to be on your guard all the time. In the daytime, if you're walking trails, you had to be constantly looking for mines. Very rarely did we ever get attacked during the daytime
mm-hmm.
in the Batangan Peninsula. And at night, you had to make sure that you set up your perimeters or your ambushes correctly, and you had to be careful to stay alert and awake. And you just had to have your act together, or you're going to get hurt.
What about the strengths people talk about today, looking back, that they were fighting in, quote-unquote, their backyard. Did that make a difference?
Sure it does. I mean, it would have made a difference if I was fighting in Peekskill, New York, where I grew up,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the jungles of Vietnam, because
mm-hmm.
I knew all the woods and the terrain in that area. I knew all the hiding places and how to get over a hill quick, or just where the trails were. It's a real advantage in a guerrilla warfare setting.
Mm-hmm.
That having been said, I mean, I never felt like things were kind of equal at night between the Americans and the Viet Cong, I thought, because what we gave up in terms of knowing the terrain, I think we made up for probably in terms of firepower and how much we could bring to bear.
Mm-hmm.
But I never felt like that we always had pretty much control of the situation in the daytime.
Right. What were the major weaknesses of the enemy, would you say?
Firepower for sure. I mean, they couldn't bring to bear nearly the amount of firepower that we could. I also had a sense that when we were being attacked by them from time to time, that there weren't nearly as many of them. You know, we had a squad of 10 people, and I always thought, there were probably two or three guys that were throwing a couple of grenades at us or something, and then they were disappearing into the woods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But to their credit, they knew what their weaknesses were. I mean, it would have been a big mistake on their part to try to stand and fight.
Mm-hmm.
That would have played into our hands.
So that was rare when they would stand and fight you.
That's exactly right. I mean, the whole time I was over there, I got into a extended skirmish or even small battle maybe twice.
Wow. And the rest was?
The rest was all hit and run. Either you were hitting them in an ambush or they were hitting you in an ambush. And it was over in a matter of, if not minutes, seconds.
Wow. How frustrating was that for you all? Or was that perfectly okay with you?
Well, it was frustrating because you realize that you have the firepower to really hurt these people,
mm-hmm.
and to win this thing. And so when you can't, it's like, chasing somebody around in a ring who if you can just get after him and lay a glove on him, you're going to knock him out,
mm-hmm.
But you. He's dancing like a butterfly and
mm-hmm.
sting like a bee kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
Steal a phrase from Mr. Ali.
That's a good analogy.
And some of this, registered at least, with some of us from a political standpoint. I never understood or disagreed a lot with how we were going about fighting this war. I thought that, we ought to be putting notice out that if you're going to control the countryside, then you have to control the population.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to control the population, then from my standpoint, is that you move the population out of the field, and so that you consider anybody that is in the field the enemy.
Okay.
And quit screwing around with all of the political governors and regional governors and chieftains, where you have to go into these zones where the rules change in terms of who can be fired upon and when you can call in artillery, and then, you know, it just gave more advantage to a guerrilla fighter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take that away from them, so that if you're in the field and you see somebody, you know, then that's the enemy.
Right. Were you all aware of the overall strategy of your enemy, that these hit-and-run tactics were basically, we know now, looking back, you know, just kind of a maneuver to, or a tactic to keep you all, you know, occupied, keep the United States occupied, and just waiting over, you know, year after year after year until we basically said, okay, enough's enough. You know, this is not going to end, or you know, we're not changing our strategy to do certain things, such as invade North Vietnam or invade Laos. Were you all aware of that big picture? Were you seeing this over time, or some of you?
Well, I think in a roundabout way, you know, the frustration with regard to the tactics we were using was, I guess, part of that. I mean, looking back, I think I had it in the back of my mind, but it goes back to what I was saying earlier. You know, we needed to control the territory, and in doing so, we needed to divide the people into, you're either with us or against us, and move the people who are with us back behind Highway 1, and then we'll consider anybody on the other side of Highway 1 the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the issue of I didn't see where body counts were getting us anywhere.
So you thought that policy was not quite the right one?
Right. That's why I say, just because you kill a few enemy doesn't mean you've won anything. You know, and you'd go up and you'd take a hilltop where you had been taking mortars or grenades from the night before,
mm-hmm.
and find a cache of weapons, and you give them back the hilltop.
Mm-hmm.
You'd leave. Well, so they're going to be right back on top of that hilltop the next morning.
Right.
With having not lost any strategic location.
Was this discussed by you all? Did you say, well, you know, this is crazy. We just did that, and they're doing this.
And I remember talking about, I may have mentioned this to you last time. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we got into a firefight one evening, one night, and it was one of the more sustained firefights, and that we were taking incoming for more than a few minutes, and we were trying to get artillery support.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we called in for artillery, but we couldn't get a political clearance from whoever the regional chief or whatever they call them for like 20 or 25 minutes. You know, in those 20-25 minutes, in the kind of warfare that we were fighting,
mm-hmm.
you know, that just ties one hand behind your back.
Right.
It was stupid.
So you all were actively discussing this on the ground?
So yeah, we'd have, you know, the frustration that we felt that we were fighting a war for the South Vietnamese, but we couldn't get an artillery clearance from this regional, and I've forgotten the term that they used, administrator, Vietnamese administration person. Mm-hmm. You know, we're fighting for his country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know that the tactics. You know, that's an example of how the tactics were in our minds absurd, and we were all pissed off about it.
Yeah. Was there anything to do about it? You couldn't change anything on the ground, or could you?
Well, I wouldn't know at my level. You know, I'm sure. You know, my company commander had something to say about it the next morning,
right,
or that night, or our platoon leader, our LT had something to say about it. But I don't know what was said, and I don't know what was said back to them.
Okay. Tell me about the tactics of the enemy. Besides a hit and run, did they do, what else would they do? Or is that what you saw mainly?
I saw a lot of, you know, we'd set up a perimeter at night. They would, and I, you know, it's hard to say you saw a lot of.
Right.
You know, you'd go for, you know, a week or 10 days and not see anything.
Mm-hmm.
But they would, I think that they would, my sense was that they would watch us and see how we were operating and try to determine where we were going to go. And in watching us, determine if we were going to go someplace that might work to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Or find or observe some type of, something that somebody was doing that they could use to their advantage, or sometimes I felt like they were out there in the woods waiting for us to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
So that they could sneak in and throw in a couple of grenades into the perimeter or where we were setting up an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
That was my sense, at least in dealing with the Viet Cong.
Okay. How about NVA? How often would you run into them?
Well, I started seeing NVA when we got out of the Batangan Peninsula and we started operating more west of Chulai,
mm-hmm.
up in the foothills, and terrain looked a lot like the hills, you know, the size of what you'd see like in Pennsylvania, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You would see the pith helmets.
Mm-hmm.
And we would I think that they were also operating in conjunction with the Viet Cong, because we continued to see some of them from time to time. But
mm-hmm.
more NVA, who had their act together with regard to RPGs and sometime, I don't know, it was in, I think, May.
Mm-hmm.
Walked into this valley and got pinned down for a couple of days, and I'm sure that was NVA.
Okay. Why do you say that? Because they were able to keep you down there?
Because they were able to sustain a kind of an ongoing confrontation longer than the VC ever would.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they had position. A kind of a triangulated high ground that they held, and they used it very well.
Steve, you described some of your tactics that you guys would do, kind of out setting up ambushes, whatnot. Can you describe some of those common tactics and how you all would actually go about doing that? I'm not sure people listening to this in the future will understand fully what it means to set up an ambush, or what it means to set up a defensive perimeter, or what it means to go search and destroy.
Most of the time when I was out in the field, I operated at at either company or platoon strength. A lot of times it was at the company would set up at night somewhere and set up a perimeter. The company consisted of three platoons, and each one of those platoons was about 25, 30 guys. The platoons were divided into three squads, 8 to 10 guys in a squad. During the day, we would so you'd set up as a company at night and try to find a hilltop or someplace that was defensible in a circle and dig your position so that you would triangulate your lines of fire if you came under attack that night, so that there would be. So if everybody opened fire at once, there would be ribbons of fire cutting through the night. It would be very difficult if everybody's firing at once to come through all of those fire zones. But there were also a lot of times we were operating in platoon, and a platoon would set up a perimeter, so it would be a smaller perimeter instead of having. Three or four guys on a foxhole, you might have two or three guys on a foxhole, and then it's tougher to stay awake because you're doing two on and two off. I mean, two hours awake, 2 hours asleep kind of deal.
Right.
Or from time to time, and usually if you went out as a squad, and that didn't happen very often during the day, unless you were sent out on some kind of tangent to check out some spot. But most often we operated as a squad at night, where we would go off the hilltop where we had set up a perimeter, either as platoon or company size, and the 8 or 10 of us would find a location near a trail that we thought that the VC or NVA may be using that night, and we'd set up an ambush.
Okay. How was that done?
Usually, it was either a semicircle or a straight line that ran parallel to the trail that you thought that the VC or NVA were going to be operating. We'd in front of us, we would set up a line of claymores, and we would set up the M60 in a position that we felt that it would could be used, to utilize the firepower as much as we could. It would hopefully take out as many of the enemy as we possibly could in the first burst. As I remember, we probably also set up a couple of claymores behind us, although usually we had some... Usually it was a lot of heavy brush, or we were in a heavy jungle, so it would have been tough to get to us from the back end without hearing a lot of whatever it was coming through the brush. So we really backed up against something that we didn't feel like somebody could come at us from the rear. And then we'd call in on the radio our exact position. You really had to know you have your act together with regard to the map, so that we could, if we got attacked or we were successful in triggering an ambush, we could also call in artillery on the position in front of us, so that the arty guys in the rear had our exact position, and they were prepared to fire at a moment's notice on the position in front of us if we called for it that night.
Right.
And then it was a lot of, it was, I've forgotten how the sleep breaks worked, but, if there were nine guys on a squad, there were at least three or four of us awake at any given time. So you're doing either 1 hour on and 1 hour off, or 2 hours on and 2 hours off. All through the night.
Was sleep deprivation a problem?
Always. You never had enough sleep in the field.
Okay.
Because if you weren't, if that was the worst, was setting up on a squad level out somewhere, on an ambush because you had eight or nine guys to divide up a whole night's sleep, and you had to have at least half the squad awake at any given time. Because you did that for safety because, you know, it's very difficult to stay awake. So if somebody does fall asleep, there are still two guys awake. You know, chances are all three of you aren't going to fall asleep.
Right.
But even if you were operating as a company on top of a hill or something where you'd set up a perimeter, mm-hmm. you were still had a couple, 3 hours of in a foxhole at night, you know, watching out for the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't think if you're in the field on any given night, you're probably not getting more than 5 hours sleep, and that's interrupted sleep. There's not more than 3 hours altogether.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. And I can imagine during the day, the heat, the movement, the stress, I mean, it
right.
took a toll on you physically for the tiredness.
Right. Well, sometimes during the day, we would stay in that same perimeter, and guys would be operating on patrols off of that perimeter. So you'd have some downtime during the day mm-hmm. where you could just kind of put up your poncho liner and stake it out and get under it and just kind of maybe snooze for a couple hours. You could catch up on that every once in a while.
Right. Was there anything that you found after you'd been there a while in the field that you wanted to do differently, that you could have done differently as far as tactics are concerned? Or was what you just described in the daily activities sufficient in your mind?
Well, I go back to what I said before. You know, I thought that our tactics were pretty good, but I thought that the in terms of the smaller picture, but you know, I thought that the bigger picture was all screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I really felt like that we needed to do a better job of differentiating the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And forcing the issue of with the people that were living out in the countryside with you're either with us or against us,
right?
And that would have made the job easier because you wouldn't had go through, you know, first trying to identify who you're shooting at.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that when you all would have to wait to call in fire missions and wait to move out on an enemy that just attacked you, people higher up than you having to check with the province chief or the village chief if it was okay to move through that region. Did you have problems like that?
Yes. Well, that goes back to...
You described that at one time.
Right. That's the one that's most vivid in my memory. Because when you're getting attacked and you can't get artillery because some province chief,
yeah.
you won't clear your artillery support, you tend to get a little frustrated.
Yes.
But I know that there had to be other times where, you know, we saw the same thing. Where,
right.
Or, again, where you'd go into a zone that, you know, would change from a free fire zone to whatever they called it zone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I never understood that. It just made no sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Was it true
if you're out there as an infantry unit, you're tying one hand behind your back if you're establishing different parts of the countryside in terms of how you can operate against the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. I mean, and that's very different from previous wars that the United States had fought where they're clear lines of demarcation.
Sure.
And
Well, I know, you know, when when the GIs in World War II went into a village or something, I guess they had to differentiate between the people who lived there in the village and the Germans that were trying to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't that same, from what I've seen or know, there wasn't that same kind of thing going on all throughout the countryside.
Mm-mm, no. Tell me about the Vietnamese civilians. How did they treat you, and what was your impression of them?
Some of them treated us very nicely. You know, some of them I wouldn't trust, you know, to turn my back on. Let me go back for a second.
Okay.
There was a time where, you know, I had supper a couple of times with a Vietnamese family, where they invited a couple of us guys into their house and they cooked a meal and it was very nice and we sat there with the mamas on and papas on and the kids and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I couldn't eat the food.
Why?
Because it was so hot. I mean, whatever spice that they were putting on this thing, you know, I'm sure it tasted fine. It was some kind of, you know, fish and egg meal, but the spice would just, you know, you think Mexican spices are hot. I mean, those Vietnamese, unbelievable things that they can eat. But that was, you know, I thought was very nice and very gracious of them to do that. But there were other villages that, you know, you just could see the people were looking at you out of the side of their eyes kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't know if it was because on a hillside, you know, a couple hundred yards away, there were VC or NVA looking down at them to see how they would handle us or what.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the realization came to me, you know, after I'd been in country, I don't know, 6 or 7 months, and we were operating with a ARVN unit. That's the South Vietnamese Army,
mm-hmm.
and in a joint operation. And you know, we came under attack somehow, we called in for artillery support, and some gunships showed up. They were strafing the hillsides where the attack had came from, and I turned around, and that ARVN unit was gone.
They had taken off.
They had Diddy Mao, man. They were gone. You know, and I said, you know, we're all sitting around talking, you know, amongst each other. Go, what are we fighting for these guys for if they won't stand and fight for their own country?
Uh-huh. Was that a common experience?
I don't know. I have heard in conventions that I go to now, some of the guys talk about that.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know if it was common or not at the time. But when I saw that they wouldn't stand and fight in that incident,
mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, if we ever leave, these guys are dead.
Wow.
Now, having said that, I mean, we had what we called Kit Carson scouts that operated with us.
Yes.
Vietnamese soldiers who went out with us to help us on patrols and help us with the terrain and logistics of being out in the field. And those guys were good guys, and they were pretty gung-ho.
Mm-hmm.
But the regular Army guys that I saw on that particular day were not good soldiers.
How debilitating was that to morale?
Well, it was very. you know, you know, in conjunction with that and seeing that at the same time, we're also becoming aware of what was going on back home.
Mm-hmm.
Because while I was over there, Kent State went on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're turning around and going, my God, you know, we're turning rifles on ourselves back home because we're at war for a people who won't fight for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've just felt like you were stuck in the middle of a bad nightmare.
After Kent State, that was more apparent, or was it before that?
Oh, it's like a whole number of things come together at once.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Kent State was, at least it hit me pretty hard. You know, I just did not understand, you know, what the hell is going on back in the States? This is nuts.
How did you all find out about it? How did you find out about it?
I think I read it in, I either heard it on the radio or read it in Stars and Stripes. I do remember seeing an article on it in Stars and Stripes, and I'm sure it was on the radio too. It was on what do they call a radio station there? I've forgotten.
Talking about the station for Vietnam itself.
Armed Forces Radio? No, I'm talking about the Armed Forces Radio.
Okay.
In Vietnam.
Right.
Right.
Well, just for a second, let's talk about the anti-war movement. How did that affect you all while you were in country?
It was a mixed bag. Because on one hand I appreciated what was the position of let's get out of this war, because I felt that if we're not in this thing to win it,
mm-hmm.
let's get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like when I was in the field that due to some of the circumstances that I described earlier with regard to political issues, and Arvin wasn't going to fight, and we were talking about, from my standpoint, we need to go conquer this land,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to just shooting people and putting numbers up on a board.
Mm-hmm.
And if we weren't in this thing to win it, then let's get the hell out of it. So from that perspective, I guess me and a lot of other guys felt like we appreciated the anti-war movement because maybe it would get us home.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we were hearing stories about, you know, how guys, you know, got home and they weren't being treated very well and being spit upon or
mm-hmm.
are being called baby killers,
mm-hmm.
we really were frustrated about that part of it and didn't get why, I mean, you wouldn't, you know, support the troops that were trying to help the people in South Vietnam. Because I think ultimately, most of us felt that the communists were bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
That as frustrated as we were about what was going on in South Vietnam and all the hypocrisy with the politics that were going on there, the North Vietnamese were not good people. The North Vietnamese, were totalitarianism. It was communism. They were going to come down there, and they were going to hurt some people if they ended up winning this war.
Right.
And so it wasn't as though we didn't feel like that the cause was just. It just what the cause was all screwed up.
Mm-hmm. when you got home, were you able to reflect more on that overall big picture, or was that something that you just wanted to move away from, move past? You're describing stuff, so you seem to be really aware when you're in country of this bigger picture. And I'm wondering, once you got through the experience, did you just drop that, move away from that?
Well, some of this bigger picture had to do with some of the images that I was seeing at the time. I really remember thinking that if we aren't in this thing to win it, let's get the hell out of here. Because I never felt like, and I think a whole lot of other guys felt the same way, that we weren't there to win it. For some reason, we were just, going through the motions.
Right.
So when I got home, I was just happy to be home.
Right.
And and I was hooking up with friends and I was fortunate in many ways that I had a rear job for the last few months that I was in Vietnam.
Right.
So I had some time being in the rear to decompress from being in the field.
Right.
It would have been, so it wasn't as difficult for me to come home. It was probably for some other guys who came out of the field. You know, they do a little stand down back in the rear someplace and then get on a plane and end up back in, Fort Lewis, Washington. And, that's a 180 degree turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas I had an opportunity to at least turn 40 degrees or so before I came home. And also when I got home, I got home in April of 1970.
Mm-hmm.
John Kerry was testifying in Armed Services Committee or whatever, wherever he was, saying we were all a bunch of heathens and war criminals. And I remember, you see it recently over the last couple of years, that we were a bunch of barbarians.
Right.
And, and people are looking at you like you're from Mars. And you're trying to, I would say to my family, I don't know where he's coming from, what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the things he's talking about, I never saw. Didn't happen in my unit.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was a combination of, and I'm not sure I'm answering your question here.
Well,
but it was a combination of if Vietnam ever came up, it was in the context of what was being portrayed as the American GI at the time, or nobody wanted to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. We can get into detail about that once we get to that point chronologically. But
I think I've digressed here.
Well, no, you answered the question, and it's an interesting observation that you have, and it's a phenomenon that did not happen before in the United States and really hasn't happened since in the United States. And it's something very worthy of discussing. Let me ask you about something else. In November 1969, the My Lai massacre news came out in public for the first time, and you're in country.
Right.
Tell me about that. How did you find out about this, and how did it affect you, and what did you think?
I don't remember when the first time when I first heard of My Lai, but I must have been in AIT.
Mm-hmm.
If it was November, I would have been in advanced infantry training
in
Fort Jackson.
That's right.
I guess I was appalled. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe that an American army soldiers would do that. In a weird sort of way, my first when I got to Vietnam, mm-hmm. and I arrived with my company, we're operating out in the same area that Lieutenant Calley was.
Yes.
So, you know, I began to, you know, by that time it was, the full investigation was really going on, and the hearings were happening. And in fact, as I remember hearing about it, there was some kind of congressional delegation, or there was a lot of investigators, high muckety muck investigators, that went to My Lai mm-hmm. at the time that I was there in the field.
Right,
and we had to spread out our company in smaller units than we had ever done before. We were out on a 4 or 5 man ambushes, and I figured out later it was because we were the, you know, they wanted trip wires everywhere while these guys were there investigating.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the human tripwires for all of these whoever was doing the investigating for the hearings that were about to happen in Congress and the court martial
right.
and whatever.
You're kind of providing security.
You were out providing security.
Right.
You know, I've digressed here a little bit. Yeah, after operating in the Batangan Peninsula. And walking through all of the minefields there,
mm-hmm.
and the frustration that goes with, you know, having all of the Vietnamese be very friendly to you during the day, and you know damn well they're throwing hand grenades at you at night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I said earlier, I don't think that there was almost every day somebody would hit a mine. In our company, or it seemed that way, and sometimes it would be a minor injury, and sometimes somebody would lose a foot or an eye, or you know, I don't think anybody ever got killed, but a lot of people got hurt by those mines. So you walk through those minefields long enough, and you do it week after week and month after month, and you think that you have a bunch of Viet Cong trapped in a village.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can understand how it would happen, but I can never condone it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you know, as frustrated as we all were out there, none of us could ever picture ourselves going in and massacring a village. There was something wrong with that unit.
How about as part of the AmeriCal division? I mean, did it make it extra difficult, for lack of a better phrase? I mean, this is your unit.
I didn't think so at the time, and I've thought about that over the years, and I guess it's left its mark on the AmeriCal over the years, but it didn't occur to me at the time.
Okay. Well, a couple other questions here before we break. Did you ever experience any friendly fire incidents? Was that something that was common?
Only from we called in artillery one night,
mm-hmm.
and either we had given them the wrong coordinates or they had the wrong coordinates, and the first few rounds that came in were virtually right on top of us.
Hmm.
I remember the RTO guy, you know, screaming into the radio, "Cease fire, cease fire, cease fire."
Mm-hmm.
I think a couple guys got hurt, but I don't remember anybody getting killed.
Okay.
But that's the only I don't ever remember anybody shooting anybody else by mistake or
right.
a grenade going off by mistake, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. Did you guys operate with snipers ever in your unit?
Not that I can remember. I do remember. We operated with dog teams in our unit from time to time. And as I said, with Kit Carson scouts.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not remember any snipers in our unit. I remember we had one guy who left the unit to go off to sniper school.
Mm-hmm.
Had a couple guys who left the unit to go be door gunners, that kind of thing.
Right. Tell me about the canine experiences.
It was great to have a dog, in the unit. But they, it was so hot that they didn't last very long. We really used them more to get the scent of, if we were in a village, get the scent of weapons, or if there's somebody down in a tunnel, get their scent, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of walking point, at least when I was walking point, the dog was behind me.
Mm-hmm.
But they also helped you, if you were in a perimeter, help come to alert in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
It was good to have their nose around.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so hot over there that, they really, you had to stop for them probably more than you had to stop, well, I know, more than the soldiers, because they just, they couldn't take the heat.
Right. So they would be out there, and you would just get a new dog, or they would just retire?
No, they'd come out with a handler.
Right.
There'd be a dog handler with them.
Would the handler take them away or give them water? Or?
Yeah, they'd slow them down and give them water. They'd go, hey, stop. We've got to stop here for a few minutes and get him some water and
mm-hmm.
let him cool off or let her cool off.
Mm-hmm.
Or, they're going to collapse from heat stroke or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How would you rate the intelligence you all received?
Well, that's hard for me to say because I was just a lowly grunt. So my orders were just kind of to go over there.
Right.
I didn't often know why. You're probably better off asking somebody who was higher ranked than I was. Ask somebody who
right.
operated as a platoon leader or a company commander. They can probably tell you that better than I could.
Okay. Steve, what about communication? Could you all communicate effectively in the field?
I thought so. I don't remember a time that we lost radio contact with unless the radio got injured. Injured. Got shot up or got. I only remember that happening once.
Mm-hmm.
Or I just don't remember not being in radio contact.
Okay, so that was not a problem. And how about like just out on ambush or. Walking the trails, you all had effective communication?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you were out in ambush, it was, you had a radio with you, and basically it was a matter of you sent, nobody talked on the radio, you sent a bunch of, the RTO operator would be listening for the headquarters in the rear. They'd call out your call sign,
mm-hmm.
and you would answer them by just clicking once or twice on the phone, sending
mm-hmm.
out two squelch signals so that you would never have to talk.
Okay. Did you ever work with troops from Australia, New Zealand, South Korea?
From Korea.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. Worked with, what do they call it? Rock Marines.
The Rocks, yeah. Tell me about them.
They were some tough son of a bitches. They really
yeah.
were.
Why?
Well, they they're physically tough. They were in your. They were. they just had a chip on their shoulder, seemed like all the time. If you had a couple beers with them, you know, and mm-hmm. they're the kind of guys that would go to their head, and you know, next thing you know, there'd be a fist fight someplace. But you know, on the other hand, I mean, and I think I only spent like a week with these guys or something, but I mean, they had their act together. They were more gung ho than we were. Very, very, very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like when we were operating with them, we were operating with some first-class infantry, as opposed to the South Vietnamese soldiers that would as I told you earlier, at least in one incident, they cut and ran.
Mm-hmm. Seems like two opposite experiences.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.